Members, we're going to call the meeting to order. So have a seat and we'll get started here. Looks like one of our authors finally showed up. Representative Sawick, will you move the minutes for today?
Oh, yes.
Representative Sawick moves approval of the minutes for February 28th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are approved. Welcome, Representative Kahn.
My
to
apologies, Mr. Chairman. I had a 100-foot driveway and a sleeping husband. I actually had to get him up to get out. So, not a good start to the day.
Well, the chair moves that House File 463 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. And Representative Kahn, go ahead with the testimony.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, has this been handled? Chris, has this been handled out? Or do we? Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill came about because I read the article that is now being passed out before you about the one of the things that we were very careful to do when we talked about disability and the rights that disabled workers have was that we never wanted to define pregnancy as a disability. We wanted pregnancy to be considered a normal part of life. But the realization is that in certain jobs, being pregnant can impose a certain amount of hardship, and it can be difficult to do it. I remembered the 100 years ago or so when I was a graduate student, and my baby was born like 1 month after the degree, I think. I was working in a laboratory, and this was before we had piping that brought you distilled water. And so one of the things that you had to do to have your supply of dill was there's a huge cask, kind of like the casks on our drinking fountains. And then you had to go fill the cask from the distilled water top, bring a step ladder, climb up on top of the counter, and put the cask way up on a shelf high in order to use it. Well, at some point, I really didn't want to do that anymore. And I was able to find people to help me do it and so forth. But there is a realization that as tough as you think you are, there are certain things that just become really hard to do. So we believe that our sex discrimination laws and our Human Rights Act do not give sufficient coverage to people who are pregnant. And several states, about 10 states, have passed a law similar to this one. And I have now people from the Better Birth Coalition who are here to testify with me.
And if you want to identify yourself for the record and welcome, first of all.
I am Judith Nylander. I'm here representing the Better Birth Coalition, which is a nonprofit, nine nonprofits, and we've come together to help work for evidence-based care for women in the perinatal years of pregnancy, childbirth, and postpartum. We've worked with the legislature over 10 years now on issues such as midwifery, doula care, and birth centers. And we're happy to be here today to support this family leave bill. I'm president of one of the nonprofits in the coalition, which is the Childbirth Collective. And I'm happy to present brief testimony from a psychologist. Krista Post is a licensed psychologist working in private practice in St. Louis Park. She's been working in various capacities of mental health since 1989. She's also the current director of the Pregnancy and Postpartum Support Minnesota. This organization provides support and education to new and expecting parents and health care providers regarding postpartum depression and anxiety. Krista has devoted her entire career to supporting Minnesota families. She's also successfully owned two small businesses. One is the founding publisher of Minnesota Parent Magazine, and for the last 10 years has had of psychotherapy practice within four clinics in St. Louis Park and Minneapolis. And secondly, we will have Veronica Jacobson, who is a childbirth educator, a birth doula, lactation counselor, and car seat technician. She left her job in industry once she realized that her passion was birth work, and she now owns a business called Baby Love, where she teaches childbirth education. We appreciate that your time is short today, and we will keep our testimony short to 10 minutes, and then we'll be around to answer questions. Veronica Jacobson speaks actually on behalf of a mother who herself has had difficulties and experienced the repercussions of returning to work at 6 weeks.
And I guess you come on up and testify then. You've been introduced. And ma'am, if you'd just identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Krista Post. I'm a licensed psychologist, as Judith said, and let me start by thanking you, this committee, for allowing me to address you today. My printer didn't work. I brought my computer, and I have to read it because otherwise I will ramble and waste all your time. I've got this down to 4 minutes. So I want to start by saying that the majority of individuals and couples that I see for counseling are within that within the pregnant through 3 years postpartum period. The reason that I focused my practice on this population is because these years are the most stressful, challenging period of our lives. Divorce actually occurs most frequently between couples who have kids under three. And if you've had that, kids under three, you know why. Additionally, when we don't get adequate support, 15 to 25% of new parents develop postpartum depression or anxiety. That's mothers and fathers. And that number goes up to 45% if you happen to be African American and make less money. So for us employers, that means that one in every 3 to 4 employees with new babies are functioning at an impaired level those first 12 months postpartum, which costs us money. Many of the women and couples I see for therapy are there because they're in crisis those first few months after having a baby. It very often takes them months to regenerate their energy, and this with lots of support from their families. I want to give you a better picture of the typical types of people I see there. I work in St. Louis Park. They come from the western suburbs. They're hard-working, ordinary people. They're often educated. They live middle to upper middle class lives. There is Sarah. I saw her yesterday. She's an admin for an accounting firm. Her delivery went well, but she had difficulty breastfeeding and developed mastitis in both breasts, which is very painful. She was committed to breastfeeding, and after returning to work at 6 weeks, she was in pain and having to pump in the women's restroom. She tells me that she cries pretty much every day, and I am watching her become depressed and more depleted. Then I see Nicole. She's a graphic designer. She has to go back March 15th. She's 7 weeks postpartum. She had a beautiful baby boy. Her husband is wonderfully supportive, but she's not been able to sleep when the baby's sleeping, and so she's been having panic attacks. I really fear for her and her family after she goes back to 40 hours a week. I'm also seeing Michael. Let's not forget Dad's. He works nights for a small trucking firm and warehouse. He and his wife have a 2-month-old and a 2.5-year-old. His wife was very sick with preeclampsia. The baby was delivered prematurely and had to stay in the NICU. So he is now caring for both his wife, who's recovering, and the baby, and none of them were ready for him to go back to work. He's very irritable and distracted on his job, driving. This is not a great way to start a family. So no matter how easy a birth is, there's a reason why doctors tell us not to exercise for the first 6 weeks after having a baby. It's because our bodies and our minds need to recover and adjust. That even in the most uncomplicated, smooth deliveries, they are bloody and exhausting affairs. Sorry about the graphics. You don't just pop out a baby and go home. You've got, in many cases, hemorrhoids and C-sections and stitches to repair with vaginal tearing. And this is really all a matter of course. There's also shifting hormones and learning how to breastfeed and enduring sleep deprivation and possible colic and reading your baby's cues. And somehow we're supposed to learn this in a month. It's all perfectly normal processing and expected challenges and it's completely draining. I'll give you two scientific findings here. Researchers have found that a woman's brain changes after she gives birth. We actually lose brain cells, and we get technically less intelligent and develop an almost ADHD quality of thought. This is a survival mechanism that we have in order to multitask. That's why we're so good at it, women. But that first year part postpartum, it makes it really hard to focus and concentrate on any one thing. This is how depression and anxiety develop. Another finding was that scientists determined that the adrenaline and cortisol levels of postpartum mammals are at post-traumatic stress levels. That is, like a soldier returning from a combat zone experience. Again, a survival mechanism to be alert. And all this is happening while doing one of the most important things anyone can do, creating a future citizen that someday you and I will have to trust to take care of us. We better hope that these babies have had enough time with their parents to bond, because healthy human attachment is the basis, of course, for becoming a competent and responsible adult able to care for others. The bottom line is that parents need more time to adjust, get their bodies and minds together, adjust to their new lives together with each other, develop a routine. And this is a cost-saving measure. It will lower our health care costs as employers. It will avoid a big government kind of spending situation, because both employers and families will be sharing the burden, that is, families having unpaid leave, so we can all feel good about sharing that responsibility. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Post and Veronica Jacobson, are you here? And members, we'll take testimony from the people on the list here, and then we'll open it up for questions. It looks like the testifiers will be around if any questions. And go ahead and identify yourself off the record and briefly give your testimony.
Good morning. I want to thank you guys for listening to this bill. My name is Veronica Jacobson.
Go ahead.
And I am the mother of two children, ages 4 and 7. I wanted to touch very briefly on the hardships that I endured when my oldest child was born over 7 years ago. Back then, I worked as an administrative assistant for a financial investment practice, and I was the only woman in my office of childbearing age. When I got pregnant, I was informed by my bosses that I would only be given 6 weeks of unpaid leave. I did not have any options for any more time. Because of this, I was required to work a 40-plus hour work week throughout my entire pregnancy, even as I developed high blood pressure. I worked every single day right up until the moment my water broke, just as I was heading to lunch. While I was gone, I was repeatedly asked by my bosses if I could return to work before 6 weeks. So when my daughter was just 6 weeks old, I did go back to work. The physical demands, despite the fact that I had a cushy desk job, the physical demands were staggering. Despite the fact that I had a vaginal birth, I was still sore and recovering from the physical demands of pregnancy and birth. But I was still expected by my employers to do everything I did beforehand. My small, sweet daughter, who still required a lot of attention and care, was off to the care of an in-home daycare, where she would have to make do with less than what she needed. After a couple months, I realized that daycare was not going to be an adequate situation for her needs. I had to scramble to find her another daycare. We found a daycare. We had to pull out 3 days later because we realized, and this is a different issue, but she was not safe in that situation. And then we eventually did find a safe place for her to be while I was at work so I could keep my job. The only way I could feel connected with my daughter was to pump milk while I was at work. I came in an extra 45 minutes to an hour early every single day so I could have that unpaid time. Eventually, though, juggling everything became overwhelming. Career, motherhood, physical, mental needs of my own. And there's still parts of my daughter's life I don't remember because I was in such a fog of postpartum depression. and developed anxiety. And my ability to cope was severely diminished because I was not able to take the time that I needed to recover, and my family suffered as a result. I'm now a business owner and a childbirth educator, and my experience as a first-time mother inspired me to support and help other new mothers on the journey where they could find the support that they needed. I'm still alarmed as I work with families how many moms have to return to work or school 6 weeks after giving birth. And some of them are make the decision to elect to have a not medically necessary cesarean because then their employer will give them 12 weeks of leave, despite the mountains of evidence that that might not be the best for mom or baby. If I had 12 weeks, I feel like my family would have been in a much better position. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Jacobson.
Thank you.
Melissa Raffan, Raffan. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please. And
certainly. My name is Melissa Raffan. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Raffan, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Employment Law Council. I am a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in the Employment Litigation Group, and I have been practicing in this arena for over 25 years. I know a number of you received the article, Pregnant and Pushed Out of Work. And what I'd like to say is the circumstances that are laid out in that article simply do not exist here in Minnesota. Believe it or not, and I know a lot of New Yorkers would find this quite ironic, New York, in the bill that was identified in that article, is trying to catch up with the law here in Minnesota. The gap that the New York bill and that the bill proposed by Representative Kahn, with whom I visited yesterday, simply does not exist here because the Minnesota Human Rights Act, Minnesota Statute 363A.08, subdivisions 5 and 6, provide for reasonable accommodation for the very conditions that are identified here, pregnancy, childbirth, and related conditions. So the issue in the article simply identifies a gap that exists under New York law, but not under Minnesota law. On that basis, we have very grave concerns about this bill. The Minnesota Employment Law Council is very selective. Obviously, a number of employment-related bills come up, and you don't see us here on every one of them. But this one raises real concerns, in the very first instance, because it is duplicative of what already exists under the Human Rights Act. Pregnant women are protected in Minnesota and have a number of avenues and venues for recourse through which they do take advantage. The second concern is that the bill is also duplicative of the Family Medical Leave Act, which does provide for 12 weeks of leave for eligible employees. And so that already does exist. The Minnesota Parenting Leave Act, which provides for 6 weeks, is less than the FMLA, but simply extends to employers who do not qualify for the Family Medical Leave Act. So in addition to the fact that the bill is duplicative of the very provisions that are outlined in the Minnesota Human Rights Act, it is also duplicative in some instances of the Family Medical Leave Act. And the third reason we have grave concerns is the language of this bill is frankly very unclear and does not contain language that the federal law does contain and that the Minnesota Human Rights Act contains, which is simply this. If someone needs a reasonable accommodation, the employer has an obligation to provide it unless it is an undue hardship. That undue hardship language is critical for responsible employers. Responsible employers look for the solution. And that absence of undue hardship language, which allows an employer to raise its hand and say, we can't make the accommodation, is not present. But I would submit to you that we don't need to even reach that issue because the gap identified in pregnant and pushed out of work does not exist here. If I might just briefly address one of the points made.
Just briefly, ma'am, because we have another testifier yet.
Yes, okay. I just want to very briefly say that the those who testified in favor of the act are testifying about a need that does not exist under Minnesota law, given the way the law is written. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Refine.
I will be available for questions.
Appreciate that. And then Mike Hickey. I saw you. There you are. Come on down, and if you'd identify yourself and go right into your testimony. And keep it reasonably short so members can ask some questions.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and I just wanted to make a few brief comments about our concerns about this bill. It was really good to hear from somebody from the Employment Law Council on the remedies that do exist, but we do realize this issue hasn't been visited for a long time around here, and our concern is with the smallest of businesses. When you have a handful of employees, there is no other department, there is no other person in another department. There is what you have, a handful of employees. And I'm sure many of our members have made some generous and lenient accommodations to their employees, but sometimes the owner will end up doing the job of the person who's gone. And when you have a handful of employees, there's just really no one else to look to. And so we're real concerned about 12 weeks and how a very small business would cope with that. And I think in some cases the owner might actually end up doing the job of the person on leave. Second, if a small business did have to hire a replacement worker, this could actually trigger an unemployment insurance complication, a claim, and possibly an increase in their unemployment insurance rate when the incumbent employee comes back. And so this kind of mandate gets really difficult in very small businesses, and I think we got to be mindful of that. And that might be one of the reasons why our current law has stayed the way it has for a long time. And there's also the remedy under the Human Rights Act. It's, you hate to hear a story like we heard a few minutes ago about somebody working that hard to keep their position and going through that kind of burden, and wish the employer had handled that differently. But there is a remedy under the Human Rights Act, as mentioned. And we're just very concerned about the burden on the smallest employers, and I think you have to be mindful of that as you act.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, that concludes our testimony. And Representative Kahn, would
Chairman, can I make a few comments
certainly.
On the testimony? And then, first of all, there are a whole set of states who have a law like this. California, Connecticut, D.C., Hawaii, Iowa, Louisiana, Maine, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. So we're not going into new ground. Second of all, the Human Rights Act does provide some protection. However, that section in the Human Rights Act does not require leave based on disability or reasonable accommodations. This is more complete. And I think if you read the language, there's a lot of particularly in subdivision 3, specifically says that's not requested, that they're not requested to hire it, to have an additional employee, or required to discharge any employee or transfer any employee. And also we specifically say that it doesn't conflict with other laws. Say one other word about this bill. Some of you remember, a lot of people were laughing after it, in the governor's State of the State speech, when he pointed out that Minnesota was first in the health of men, but second in the country in the health of, for the health of women. And then he had this laughing remark, which everyone asked me how I got in, saying, I imagine Representative Kahn will be taking care of that. Well, the next day I introduced this bill as the first step to take care of it. And I wouldn't be surprised if one of those states whose name I read was first.
Very good. Representative Metzler, you had a question?
Just a comment. I did want to let the rest of the members know that Phyllis, or Representative Kahn, I'm sorry, the 12-week leave would be also conforming to federal labor law.
Yeah.
Thanks for your comment, Representative Kahn.
The I have several. I didn't want to burden you at this time, but I have several other articles about EEOC cases. So there are lots of, I mean, the alternative to passing this law is turns out to be court cases, which are more timely and more unpleasant for everyone. And FMLA, the federal law, has a lot of restrictions, of which this law, first of all, it has to be 50, only applies to firms of over 50 employees. You have to have worked for your employer for at least a year. You have to work for an employer for at least over 1,000 hours in the past year. And it is much more restrictive than this, which is why states have felt the need to pass other laws.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Kahn and Representative Metza, this isn't conforming to the federal.
No.
We are extending the protection actually below a level of employment. The federal law is 50 or more employees, and so I'm not going to get into that. I have some real questions, though, mostly around Subdivision 2. And I had an organization so large that I had a reasonable accommodation committee, and my worry is that in Subdivision 2 especially, we're becoming so descriptive or prescriptive here in terms of an employer must provide reasonable accommodation for an employee for conditions related to pregnancy, childbirth, includes but not limited to seating, frequent restroom breaks, and limits to heavy lifting. Just in prescriptive in that, I might not have a job that I seat anybody. And I always found that allowing for businesses to work with the employee on what reasonable accommodation, and this is a must with unless it provides unreasonable burden. And, you know, and just about anything, any federal law, we'll get back to this unreasonable burden piece. And that's a pretty, that's a big hill to climb. So for those who, around the table here today and in the audience to think, well, the Representative Benson's not for helping these people, believe me, if an employer does not make a reasonable accommodation and it can be proven in a court case, they're still liable. They're still in big trouble. I just worry that we're getting way too prescriptive. I guess if we were going to try to do something, maybe it would have, in my mind, we would have possibly extended it to employers less than 50 with the 12 weeks. But I think we're writing a whole lot more. I think we're going to have more lawsuits, not less, is my fear.
Well, yeah,
very good. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. I actually have a question for Melissa Rapan. Rapan?
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 Rapan? Go ahead with your question, Representative.
Thank you. In your testimony, you had said that that this is duplicative and that between the human rights, the Federal Family Leave Act, and the law in Minnesota already that covers to 21 where they have 21 to 49 employees, the Minnesota Parenting Leave Law, between those three, this is duplicative, and Representative Kahn had a statement that said that that was not accurate. Can you just speak to that again? Because I'm confused as to what's actually in the law. Maybe you could explain one more time the duplicative nature. And I also want to just, before I give up the floor here, defer back here to Representative Benson and how, as a small business owner myself, how incredibly burdensome, and you know, if I have two employees, there's a reason why in Minnesota law it goes down to 21 employees. If I have two employees and one of them's out on medical leave, you know, what am I supposed to do? I mean, I just want to make that as a statement, but I really want to clarify what you had to say first,
Ms.
about
Rapan,
the duplicative
Ms.
nature.
So I will address, there are really two prongs that we're speaking about in this bill. As it relates to the reasonable accommodation aspect, wherein the bill requires an employer to make a reasonable accommodation for pregnancy, childbirth, or conditions related to pregnancy or childbirth, I would ask you to look at Subdivision 5 of the Minnesota Human Rights Act called Fringe Benefits, which specifically requires an employer to treat conditions like pregnancy, childbirth, or disabilities related to pregnancy or childbirth the same way it would any other disability and imposes a duty on Minnesota employers with 15 or more employees to reasonably accommodate those individuals. So that protection, that prong already exists. With respect to the leave, it is true that the FMLA has certain threshold requirements that not every Minnesota employer is going to meet, but I think for the points that Representative Benson made and that you made, certain employers below a certain size have a very difficult time accommodating people with a 12-week leave. So I think that is a separate issue.
Very good. Representative O'Neill, follow up?
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Chair. So what we didn't talk about is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And can you speak a little bit to that and how that covers this exact same part of law, that if a woman is temporarily unable to perform her job due to medical condition related to pregnancy or childbirth, the employer or other covered entities must treat her in the same way as they treat other temporarily disabled employees. Can you speak to that as well, please?
What I would say under the Americans with Disabilities Act is this, that the act requires an employer to accommodate any disability. Pregnancy is not per se a disability, but conditions arising out of the pregnancy could qualify as disabilities within the meaning of the ADA and thus trigger the reasonable accommodation prong.
Good.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Sawak?
I only have one question, and it's for Ms. Rapan. If this is all the same as the laws that we already have, why are you so opposed to it?
And that's a very fair question, and I will answer it like this. What I'm saying is that the protection sought in the bill is already addressed in other laws. And when we talk about grafting on a law that, frankly, is very unclear and subjective in some of the language, the number of lawsuits that would arise from the passage of this bill, I promise you, would be very significant. If I were a human resources person, the person at any company responsible for implementing this, I would really feel like sobbing if I read the language of this bill, because the language opens up a tremendous opportunity for lawsuits. And I think Minnesota at this point is seen as providing a number of protections for employees and recourse for addressing it when those protections are not provided. And that safeguards already exist. So what we would essentially be doing is opening up the door to lawsuits for no reason because the rights already are being protected.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have one question, maybe for Representative Kahn, maybe for staff. But I heard Mr. Hickey talk about the impact of small business, and then I heard Representative O'Neill talk about the impact of small business. And maybe I'm wrong, but is it my interpretation that this bill under the statute would only apply to employers with 21 or more employees? Am I incorrect in saying that?
Representative Kahn?
I think so. I think, although I would certainly be amenable to putting some kind, that the 21 employees is the Human Rights Act. And I think one of the things that we do say is that we do say that it's that nothing in the section shall be construed to affect any other provision of law relating to sex. So you could say that covered the 21, you know, that would be, if you applied it to under that would be a conflict with that law. So you could say that that's all right.
Briefly, Representative Simonson.
Okay, thank you. Just quickly, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Kahn, just so I understand, that was your intent as the author of the bill,
yes,
not to conflict
to
with that?
That it would go along. The intent was, and, you know, I don't want to pretend that anything is perfect as written. The intent was is that we never wanted to have pregnancy considered to be a disability. And so what this does is kind of give the rights to people with women who are pregnant, similar to those of people with disabilities, without having to say that pregnancy is a disability, just recognizing that it might need some temporary reasonable accommodation.
Very good. Representative Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, would you be interested in laying this bill over so we could get information that confirms the 21 benchmark on this? The reason I ask that is you've suggested that you don't want this to that there's some discrepancies between the Minnesota Human Rights Act and this situation that we're putting forward today doesn't fall under that, but then we're going to quickly slide, but maybe it does under the Human Rights Act. I think we need clarification on this.
Recep Khan?
Well,
okay. And Representative Khan.
Well, as I said, I thought that that section fixed it. Of course, there are, you know, more knowledgeable people than me on this committee. There was some question of whether the bill needed to go to civil law. Is that a thing that we're still looking
at? Mr. Chair,
Representative Driscoll?
I had suggested that maybe we want to go to civil law. For the last 30 minutes, all I've heard is litigation, employers, lawsuits, and things, and I think that's something that we want to take a look at. But maybe Ms. Newman could help shed some light on the amount of employees that this particular proposed bill would cover.
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I have no idea the number of employees trigger of you have to have a minimum number of employees to trigger that. The state Parental Leave Act has a minimum number. The Human Rights Act that was cited covers employers who have 15 or more part-time employees over a certain period of time. So each of those provisions covers, but they have minimum employment requirements. This bill doesn't have a specific
very good. We have two people on the list here, and then we're going to move to a vote or one. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Yeah, and that was my deep concern as a small business owner of less than 15 employees, that this is, and what Ms. Newman just stated is that it's not described in your bill, and I read it that it would cover all employees, or excuse me, all employers of all levels. So, like I said before, if I have two employees and one of them is pregnant and I lose that person, what am I supposed to do, Representative Khan? I have a really hard time with that. Maybe you'd be, again, amenable to either going to civil law with this or laying it over so we can get that clarification, because I'm certainly not comfortable moving forward with this, not knowing what size employer we are talking about, because this could be incredibly burdensome for an employer smaller than 15 employees.
Well,
and just to, you know, I am very, you know, I have been through three pregnancies myself working full-time, so I'm not unfamiliar with this territory, Representative Khan. I actually had a C-section, had to return to work. I had a condition where I was on bed rest. And I guess my other question would be, Representative Khan, what I didn't hear in the testimony, which is great, is tremendously concerning to me, is I didn't hear any of the people really working with their employer to say, you know, I need more than 6 weeks. Is there anything that we can do? I need some of these conditions. In all of the testimony I've heard, I haven't heard any employee actually working with their employer to try to work through some of these issues. So I'm wondering if any of your testifiers actually, you know, if some of the, one was giving examples from other people, but if they actually worked with employers and how that worked and how many employees maybe the firm that you worked with, was it 15 or less employees?
So I was in a kind
Ms.
of a...
Jacobson?
I'm sorry.
Just to the chair and then...
Okay. Sorry,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize.
Okay.
Just to clarify the point, I was my payroll was being handled through a staffing company so that my employer didn't have to do the weekly calculation. So I was in an odd situation. It was very unclear. I did try to work with both my employer, the HR department of the payroll company. I found out through working with them that actually my employer had decided to not allow me to get short-term disability benefits. So that was their choice. And worked very hard to try to figure something out so that I could get more time, but was told basically this is it or nothing. It was it was a little bit unclear about the 15, but if you count that I was an employer employed by the staffing company, then it did meet the 15 minimum threshold.
Representative Buglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just a comment. I'm very, very concerned about the trials and tribulations of women in the workplace, particularly when they're pregnant. I think the intent of all of these laws is very, very good. However, I don't think it's this body's best intentions to pass duplicative laws and laws that probably you know, where we already have some coverage for this. I would like to see this also laid over, or at the very least, as Representative O'Driscoll said, go to civil law. I just, the testimony about opening this up to so many lawsuits and things and HR people, I haven't heard from any HR professionals, and I think that would be a good part of some testimony. So I guess I would really, really hope that we could spend a little more time on this and also go to civil law. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Representative Kahn, what I'm going to do is renew my motion that this matter be recommended passed, but we are going to re-refer to civil law because it looks like there are some issues, and I think members in the committee are kind of in agreement that. So what I'm going to do at this point,
Mr. Chair, I hate to interrupt you, but we may want to, from some of the sidebar conversations that Ms. Newman and others and I have had, and I apologize, but I just think this is something for the committee to take into consideration. There are a couple of conflicts that we've seen in here that maybe we may want to do some amendments, bring it back tomorrow, and then move it to civil law. That seems to be the general consensus of the DFL research as well as House research that we may want to look at doing that to clean some of those kinds of things up.
And would you like to make a motion to that effect?
Mr. Chair, I'd make the motion to that effect.
Representative O'Driscoll moves that the matter be laid over to take a look at tomorrow.
Okay. Seems like a good idea.
All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And we're going to move on to the next bill at this point. Okay. Representative Atkins, come on down. House File 602. The chair moves that House File 602 be recommended passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. And it looks like you have an author's amendment. Is that correct?
I do, Mr. Chairman. It's the A1 amendment.
The chair will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
I oppose. Motion passes. The bill is in the form the author desires. And to your amended bill, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I won't be long because I've got a couple of terrific testifiers. But what this legislation does is it basically says that when somebody reaches out and gives you a handshake and says that they're gives you their word on something, you're going to hold them to that. We've had an epidemic of very significant proportions in use of this lockout tool. We used to never see employers use that tool in Minnesota. Now we've, whether it's the orchestras or the Minnesota Wild, which have gotten a lot of attention, or the Crystal Sugar situation out in western Minnesota that's been going on for, a year and a half, almost 2 years now, it has dramatic and dire impacts on communities. Not just the employees, but the surrounding communities. We've had testimony in another committee about the sort of significant and horrible impact that it's had on entire communities in western Minnesota. So what this bill does, Mr. Chairman and members, is quite simple. It just says that if an employer makes the decision to enter into a lockout and as a result of that puts people out of work, it extends their unemployment benefits. No different than something that we did a couple years back with extension of some unemployment benefits as part of the federal stimulus dollars. But this says if an employer makes that decision on their own and decides to do that, that they ought to pay the price for that. And then secondly, as a result of the amendment, we hold organizations that have come to us and said, give us a subsidy. because we'll increase economic activity and we'll grow jobs. And then in the case of the Minnesota Wild, for example, or a couple of the orchestras, they turn around and in no time start locking folks out and hurting economic activity and putting people out of work. All this this amendment says that's now part of the bill is if you do that, then we can suspend that money that we were given to you to increase economic activity and jobs. That's why I call it kind of that handshake agreement. If you give me your word then and you break that word, there's going to be a little bit of a penalty for that. It's a simple bill in that respect, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate members' support, and there is a little bit of testimony here on behalf of the bill.
Thank you for your bill presentation. And Wendy Williams and LaVon Frumke, if you want to come up to the testifier's table. And I ask that you identify yourself for the record and go ahead and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to address you this morning. I'm Wendy Williams. I play second flute in the Minnesota Orchestra. I've been a member of the Minnesota Orchestra for 20 years, and I moved to Minnesota from the Houston Symphony after winning a national audition for my position. Though I tried to prepare financially for the possibility of a work stoppage in the months prior to our lockout in October of last year, I was in the midst of a difficult divorce. It had a devastating economic effect, leaving me in a vulnerable position financially with debt, depleted savings for retirement, and overwhelming legal bills. I became solely responsible for the mortgage and expenses of my home, and the lockout has deepened that vulnerability as I fight to keep my home for my two children. Unemployment benefits that I have received have been essential in my situation. I have done everything possible to earn income since the lockout, seeking new private flute students and applying for work as a substitute teacher, though neither has come close to replacing my lost income and benefits. I have reached out to contacts in other orchestras around the country for substitute work, but because I am responsible for my children 5 days a week with additional responsibilities for my mother with memory loss and health issues, I have limited ability to travel. I recently accepted, gratefully, a week of work from the St. Louis Symphony. Unfortunately, my 12-year-old son had an emergency surgery for a ruptured appendix at the beginning of that week. Hoping that he would recover quickly and desperate to earn income, I left him in the hospital and flew to St. Louis. This was a very low moment for me in the course of this lockout. I wept being away from my sick child. He developed complications requiring a second surgery, and I cut short my work to fly home and be at his bedside. Without continuing unemployment benefits, I fear that I will lose my home and further disrupt my children's lives. My colleagues and I are doing everything we possibly can to move our negotiations forward so that we can return to our work. We have reason to fear now that we will be locked out until at least the end of 2013. The musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra and our colleagues in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra greatly appreciate your consideration in this difficult matter.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Ms. Frumke, if you'd identify yourself the record and please begin your testimony.
LaVon Frumke.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I am a locked out American Crystal Sugar worker from Crookston, Minnesota. I have worked for Crystal Sugar for 34 years. In 1977, I worked in a furniture store. A customer that I had come to know said I could make more money if I applied at Crystal Sugar. I applied and was hired that very day, making much more money than my other job. I was a single parent working shift work during sugar beet processing, missing a lot of my children's school and church activities. About 14 years later, I became a year-round working my way up the ladder to finally become storeroom foreman. I bought a home, raised my family, and made a middle-class living. In fact, I'm still trying to pay off my home. In 2011, I heard rumors that there may be a lockout about a month before it happened. I couldn't believe it would happen. After it did, I felt like I had been slapped in the face. How could this happen to me and my brothers and sisters that have dedicated their lives to Crystal Sugar? This lockout has been a financial hardship for me and my family. I have exhausted my savings and the bills are piling up. The lockout has affected the whole community by dividing it down the middle. Families are divided too. Many of our workers have family that are farmers and beet growers that are not speaking to each other. The reason this bill is important to the workers is that we want to work. We were willing to work under the old existing contract that was in place. It is the company that locked us out, not by our choice. A company should not be able to strangle and destroy workers through weaknesses in the law. This bill evens the playing field, is fair and just. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
And thank you so much for your testimony. Mr. Gerber? You can have a seat in the audience, and that'd be great.
And Mr. Chairman, while Mr. Gerber is coming down, we literally could have had scores of testifiers, all talking along the same lines of what our individual witnesses are. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Gerber, who's, I'm sure, here to support the bill.
Welcome, Representative Gerber, if you want to identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We are an organization of 2,400 large and small businesses across the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to oppose this bill for two important reasons. One, for policy reasons, and the second being that we believe this enacting this law would be unconstitutional for various reasons. I think the first reason why we would I'll address the policy concerns. It makes Minnesota we see on numerous fronts attempts to make Minnesota an increasingly less friendly state to do business, and I think this is one of those examples where you're taking away a right that has been granted under the National Labor Relations Act and turning it on its head. I'll be short on that on the policy front. I think there's three reasons why we would feel that this is unconstitutional. The first being the extension of unemployment benefits in perpetuity. The second being an assessment of an administrative penalty, and then the recoupment of the public subsidy. Article 6, Clause 2 of the United States Constitution is known as the Supremacy Clause. It establishes the Constitution and federal statutes as supreme law of the land. Congress enacted the National Labor Relations Act as the comprehensive code for labor management relations. The National Labor Relations Act reflects Congress's intent to create a uniform national body of labor laws to be administrated at the federal level to the exclusion of states. The San Diego Building Trades Council v. Garmin case states that where a state law regulates either activity that the NLRA protects, prohibits, or arguably protects or prohibits, or certain areas that have been left to be controlled by the free player economic forces, it is invalid and preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. A lockout is recognized as a legitimate means of applying economic pressure in support of bargaining positions and is a well-settled and unquestioned right of an employer under the NLRA, and that's in the American Shipbuilding Company case. Congress's decision to prohibit certain forms of economic pressure while leaving others unregulated represents an intentional balance. Federal law intended to leave the employer and union free to use their economic weapons against one another. States are prohibited from imposing additional restrictions on economic weapons of self-help, such as strikes or lockouts, and interfering with substantive aspects of the bargaining process. A defensive lockout is a subspecies of an employer's economic tool, as recognized in NLRB v. Brown, a United States Supreme Court case. In certain circumstances, such as agriculture, when harvests occur, a union has a heightened ability to disrupt an employer's operation and cause direct economic loss. Believing a strike is imminent or one has been threatened at a critical time, an employer can utilize a defensive lockout to preserve their economic interests. Such actions by an employer is wholly, as according to the Brown case, I quote, wholly consistent with a legitimate business purpose. This is a clear interference in the bargaining process that we believe is an impermissible state action. It tips the scales in favor of unions and employees and the employees that they represent to the detriment of businesses in our state. Courts have consistently struck down regulations such as this which impact the collective bargaining process and discourage a party from exercising its rights. The Minnesota Supreme Court struck down such a law as preempted where the legislature made it an unfair labor practice to grant replacement workers permanent status in the Midwest Motors Express case. The court held that with the substantive aspects of bargaining, by branding an unlawful and economic device, Congress intended to be regulated. The second issue would be the assessment of an administrative penalty. State measures that stand to impermissibly manipulate the employee-employer balance of power in bargaining have been uniformly rejected by the courts of this land. I would direct you to the United States Steelworkers of America v. Johnson case. The Minnesota legislature has done just this thing before with it being struck down. The legislature enacted a measure which granted unions leverage over mine operators in the Iron Range in receiving monies for facility and equipment in the Thunderbird mining case. The district court invalidated the law as preempted, finding that it granted substantial economic power to the union and substantially and permanently shifts the terms of bargaining in favor of the union. I'd like to address the recoupment of a public subsidy very briefly. I promise this will be my last statement. The United States Supreme Court has found unconstitutional similar efforts by a state to condition a government benefit on conforming labor relations behavior. In the Golden State Transit v. City of LA case, the U.S. Supreme Court said that Los Angeles conditioning a renewing a taxi franchise on the employer reaching a labor agreement with its union conflicted with congressional intent reflected in the NLRA and destroyed the balance of power designed by Congress, frustrated Congress's decision to leave open the use of economic weapons between the employers and the employees. By conditioning the retention of public subsidies and refraining from exercising a right, the legislation shifts all the power to the unions to the disadvantage of employers in this state. And the intent behind all these laws is to strike a balance. We're not here to argue that one side should have a greater tool than the other. They both have equal tools, in this arena. And the NLRA is the exclusive the NLRB and the NLRA is the law authorizing and controls this area of employment law. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Gerber. Representative Atkins, do you want to address any of the concerns raised at this time, or do you want to hear from legislators first?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take questions and then have some closing comments that will be in response to some of the concerns.
Very good. Representative Sundin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks to the author for bringing us forward. Just a couple observations and maybe a question to Mr. Gerber. I've personally witnessed some of the devastating effects of the lockouts up in northwest Minnesota and in North Dakota, and it's just a drain on the whole economy up there, and it's just an embarrassment that this situation could happen. Again, thanks to the author for bringing this forward. Just a concern about the penalties levied towards the employers. It's the last thing I'd ever want to see is a business damaged, by any legislation that we could bring forth. But I fully realize the intent of this is to force these employers to the table and foster a good collective bargaining process. Is that true?
Representative Atkins?
Chairman, Representative Sundin, absolutely. Right now we have an extremely unbalanced playing field. Most of the because of the ability for an employer unilaterally to decide to do a lockout, eventually, particularly when unemployment benefits run out, it places the two in a completely unbalanced position of power. All this is trying to do is level the playing field a little bit and try to get both sides to have equal leverage when it comes to collective bargaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question to Mr. Gerber. Have you ever been to one of those outpost camps where the lockout workers are posted along I-29 and witnessed the devastating effects of the families?
Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sedin, yeah, I have driven through that area during the lockout, but I'd like to address the statement that Representative Atkins just made. I mean, you just heard on the record that the intent was to balance the power. That is under the exclusive purview of the NLRA. So, I mean, just on that statement alone, this type of legislation would be unconstitutional.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is Mr. Caligari in the audience? I thought I saw him. I'd like to ask you a question, please.
Representative Benson, go ahead with your question, and if you'd identify yourself once you're asked.
Is there any other area of law where we apply an administrative penalty like this, the one that's in this bill?
Mr. Chair.
And again, identify yourself so people know who you are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Caligari. I'm Director of Unemployment Insurance at Deed. And this is a little different nuance. It's basically the Minnesota tax laws are structured such that, again, the concept is employers pay for unemployment. And so there are base rates and experience ratings. And so this provision provides that if it, for a maximum experience rated employer, the charges then are directly charged back to the employer instead of being socialized by the rest of the employers who pay into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
Representative Benson, follow up?
Yeah, thank you. In this case, this is a direct penalty to the company that's performing the lockout. They may see it as an economic necessity. There's only way that they can stay in business is to have this lockout. So this will be a direct cost right back to the company, not spread out over the industry, so to speak, but will be directly tied back to them. So they'll be paying for the lockout, essentially.
Ms. Caligari?
Mr. Chair, members, the charges would be, in the case of a maximum rated employer, would go directly to that employer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
Do we do this anywhere else in law? Anywhere?
Caligari?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not aware that we've done this before.
And to Representative Atkins?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Benson's question, it's called holding people accountable, and we do it all the time.
Thank you, Mr.
One last question?
Yeah, I guess a statement in terms of, but in this case, it's an unequal treatment. We're not holding everybody accountable, just the employer, and I think that's the biggest issue in this bill, is that we're not looking at the conflict we have here, in that it's really one-sided. It takes two people not to come to an agreement on a contract. And we're not holding the other party, the union, to the same level of responsibility in this as the employer.
Mr. Chairman, to Representative
Atkins,
question. You're wrong. Right now, if a union decides to strike and not go to work, they get zero unemployment benefits. All this is saying that if an employer engages in a lockout, that they ought to extend those benefits and pay the costs of that lockout. Right now, you know who ends up shouldering it, Representative Benson, is all the rest of us. Because when those UI benefits come running out, all those folks, and all you got to do is, Representative Sundin talked about and others, is look at those communities that are devastated across western Minnesota as a result of the lockout that's happening with American Crystal Sugar. And where do those people turn for help? They turn for help to those communities that are around them, and they turn to help to the state of Minnesota. When it's American Crystal Sugar, that unilaterally made the decision to lock out those employees.
And Representative Benson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess the other thing that you're not thinking about, though, is that if we make these businesses uncompetitive and they move out completely, we're still left with a bag, aren't we?
More of a comment, perhaps. Let's move to Representative Fisher.
More of a comment along the lines is when I take a look at this, I not only look at the labor side, but I also look at the fact that in terms of unemployment situations in the past, when we've had hardships in this country that have been very devastating to the communities, we've had extra unemployment that's been put out, whether it was on the national recession that we had where we extended benefits, or when in other areas when employers go out of business. If you're going out of business, there's certain provisions they have to put on, notices that they have to put out, extra benefits that are available to the employees in those situations. And when I take a look at the impact that a major employer can have on the local community, to me this seems to be a devastating impact. And what we're trying to do is address something that's unusual, because when you're taking a look at lockouts, if they go on for very long periods of time, you're in a situation where all of a sudden you can have the same impact of an employer closing down and putting that many people out of jobs. There's notices, et cetera, that are not being given out in those instances. So I think this here is a very appropriate way to address a situation that's not just that is happening to the employees' employers, but it's also having an impact on the wider community as a whole. And so as a result, I think it is something that is very appropriate for us to enter into from that economic perspective.
Very good. And then to Representative O'Driscoll, and then to Representative Atkins for final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, a couple questions I'm hoping to learn something here today, because I thought I knew some things about labor law, but maybe I need to know a few more things here today. You've indicated a couple times today that lockouts are unilateral. What are strikes or work stoppages?
And Representative Atkins? Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, unilateral as well, and that's why there's a penalty to those folks who choose to do it, which is they don't get to collect unemployment benefits. Thank you for making that point.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Atkins, if that's the case, then right now, lockout, no benefits, strike, no benefits. Both sides have to kind of weigh out their strategy, don't they?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, actually, you're missing a point. There's three possible scenarios. Strike ends up with no lockouts or no unemployment benefits. You move into the position of traditional layoffs and that sort of thing. That's where unemployment kicks in. But now we're in this third realm where an entity decides to unilaterally just lock people out. That should extend those unemployment benefits if an employer opts to follow that course.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, I think we're going to have a little bit of difference of opinion on that, which is okay. But let's use the example of a nonprofit organization that may receive a subsidy on this. What happens if your bill becomes law? And that nonprofit organization says, you know what, instead of a lockout, we'll just disband.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, arguably the Minnesota Wild, for example, would contend that they were nonprofit for quite some time. If they come to us and seek a subsidy promising economic activity and jobs, then all I'm asking is that they live up to that promise. No more, no less. But if they don't live up to their end, then we ought not to have to live up to our end.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, living up to their end of the bargain, if the rules change after they receive that subsidy and the business climate or the, as we heard from some testifiers who are members of a nonprofit, if they step back and say, well, making a business decision going forward, we can't continue to go, we can't afford the wage structure, the benefit structure, or whatever the other underlying issues were, if they just file to cease existence, then don't the good folks in the state of Minnesota get the UI benefits that you were talking about, having to pay those? I'm curious to see what your thoughts are on that.
Representative Atkins? And then if you want to move into your closing comments at the
Mr.
same
Chairman,
time.
Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not quite sure that I understand if they close down, yes, they'd collect unemployment benefits. I'm not arguing with you on that point. Maybe I just missed the point of the question, though. But
you hit it right on.
Yes, if they decide to close, but you also made the point that if things change for them versus when they sought the public subsidy and they take a different course, that ought to allow those of us that provided the public subsidy, those tax dollars, to also take a different course. And that's what this bill provides for, Mr. Chairman, and all it is holding people to their obligations, holding them accountable for their actions, and I appreciate the members' support.
Very good. The chair moves that House File 602 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Bill passed. Members, that's all we have for today. We will be meeting tomorrow to look at some bills and maybe the one we laid over as well. So until then, meeting adjourned.